Showcase. Hello, and welcome to the second stream on this first night, and I'm now here with Frode Midyard. Frode, I think everyone knows you. You're obviously famous of the Skanza Forum and Guide to Culture, among other things. Would you like to introduce yourself briefly?
Sure, I can do that, but I just want to alert you to the fact that it looks like it's the wrong stream that's up, because I was just going to share the link, and it seems like it's the previous stream that's active on Odyssey now. So, anyway,
my God, right? Let me have a look.
All right.
Okay.
Well, I can introduce myself in the meanwhile, or shall we start over?
No, let's. Let me see what's happening here.
All right.
All right, your past live streams. Okay. I don't know how you're supposed to do this. They've changed it all since last year. Okay, it's saying, so let's see this one. Yeah, there it is. There it is. It's at the correct URL.
Okay.
Yeah, it seems to be okay.
Good. Okay. Well, yeah, my name is Frode. I guess I'm sort of known for several different things. The Skanza Forum, of course, which is a series of conferences that we did in Scandinavia, in Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. It's been on a break since COVID started, and the lockdowns prevented everyone from traveling, so we haven't really had a chance to do anything since then. And I also run Guide to Culture, a channel with cultural conversations, discussions, and so on. And right now, I guess the most sort of prominent thing, my flagship show, is Weekly Roundup with Mark Weber. So I do a weekly show on current events, on news commentary, and so on with Mark Weber. Mark Weber is a historian, an American historian, who has been in the game for a very long time, for many decades. He is the head of the Institute for Historical Review. And so he has written a lot about the Second World War and issues related to the Second World War and Western history. But right now we're talking about current events. And I'm proud to say that I probably have made him known to a new generation of people in sort of dissident or right-wing circles or whatever you want to call it. So that's what I'm doing right now. And I also do film reviews. I do the Decameron Film Festival. I do a lot of different things. So I don't know how how deeply I should go into this introduction, but I've been doing I've been involved in these kinds of things for 25 years, I think. So there's a lot that could be said.
Yeah, I just wanted to give people a general flavor of who you are, just in case, in the unlikely event that they don't know already.
I think this is my sixth appearance on Millennial. You know that you're getting old when you start saying time flies, but I'm surprised that it's already 6 years.
I think the first one was 2017.
Yeah,
because that was the year that I spoke at your conference in Oslo.
That's true. That's right. That's when we got to know each other. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So I would have invited you on to Millennial at the end of that year, which was the first sort of really big Millennial. And then every year since then, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm glad. I should say that I have these lozenges, Halls Extra Strong, and it's just in case it looks surly or, you know, off me to be...
Is that product placement?
One of these... No. The opposite. But the just in case it looks bad, it's because I've got a head cold just now, so That's why. All right. So, Frode, we're going to discuss the year from your perspective. So this was 2022. This is I went into this with the previous guest, White Papers. That obviously 2020 was, I would use the term revolutionary, radical. I would still say that now. I think it was a big departure from life as we had known it. That very much continued into 2021 as with the COVID stuff, the vaccines and all that. And then 2022 was different in a sense. I mean, the COVID stuff, the World Economic Forum and all that, it is still persisting. But we've also seen the resurgence of a force that was quiet through those 2 years, which is America as the global hegemon. And I use the word America to mean multiple things, obviously. So, so Frode, what would you say about this?
Yeah, 2022 has been an eventful year in many ways, and it's becoming more and more difficult to predict anything that's going to happen in the future, because who would have said 3 years ago or 5 years ago how things would look today? I mean, we have had the COVID lockdowns that have, I think, in a way, almost, well, it's difficult to say permanently yet, but they've been all over for the most part of a year. And I still think we see some lingering effects in people's psyche in the sense that...
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I'm amazed there's any doubt about that.
Yeah.
You know, if someone were to say to me, it's all over now and it's had no effects, it's had no lasting effects, I'd think that they were insane or just delusional.
Yeah, I mean, just take for one example, take all the conferences, the events and so on that were going on before, and all of those have disappeared, almost all over Europe, in the Netherlands and Finland and other places. And I think that people have become more passive. And I mean, lockdowns, you know, this is sort of a cliche, but the point is that, you know, you use them in prison to break people down, right? People who are not under control, you use them to control people, to break them, to break their will and break their spirit. And I'm not saying that that was the intention. I'm not going to pretend that I can mind read, but I think that that was part of the effect, that people became more passive. They got used to a different lifestyle from living under these circumstances for an extended period of time. And I think people got used to that. Now, a lot of stuff has gone back to normal. And I guess that's sort of the thing that opened this year in January, February. Borders opened again. People were allowed to travel. And the first thing, well, I did a lot of things actually at the start of this year. I recorded a bunch of interviews, a bunch of very important milepost in my own work. I did a big interview with Kevin MacDonald and Ricardo Duchesne about Kevin MacDonald's book, Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition. It ended up being a total of 8 hours, around 8 hours. It's divided up over four episodes, four interviews, where we sort of went over the book chapter by chapter. And I think that was an important part of the work that I did. And then in February 23rd, which is the day before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, on February 23rd, I gave a speech at a conference in Estonia, at the Ethno Future Conference in Estonia. And I did it over video link because I wasn't able to travel to Tallinn at the time. And it was right after the borders had opened up again. And for those who are not familiar with it, Ethno Future is organized by Blue Awakening, which is the youth wing or the youth group, the sort of metapolitical group within the Estonian Conservative Party, which is, I believe, the second largest party in Estonia. They were a part of the government, and I think an election is coming up now. But it's either the largest or the second largest party of Estonia. so that's it's very different in Eastern Europe compared to in other parts of Europe. I gave a speech alongside the Minister of Finance in Estonia a couple of years ago. So there's the establishment there is a bit more. There's a bit more free speech and a bit more openness to my kind of ideas and so on. I gave a speech about retribalization, and the purpose of that speech, it's a speech that I'm very proud of because a lot of people talk a lot about what's the way forward, what can we do, how can we change society, and essentially the point that I make in the speech, have you heard it, by the way?
No, I haven't, I'm afraid to say.
All right. I put it out for in public just a couple of weeks ago. So it's available on Odyssey and elsewhere. But the point of the speech is essentially that there's very little we can do to change overall society. And there's very little we can do through politics. If we mean changing what other people do, how other people think, and changing the general power structure, we're basically powerless in that sense. There's very little we can do in the short term to affect those things. And I think that has been shown not least by the recent events in the last few years, where just the overall way that society works just changed in front of our eyes and no one had any say in it. There's very little we can do. And the society also with this sort of technological aspect, high-tech aspect, has changed in a way that old patterns of seeing things and understanding things, they don't really work anymore. So the point is that what I suggest in that speech is that we need to see this as a paradigm shift, and that's something that I've been talking about for many years, that what needs to happen is a paradigm shift similar to what happened in the Roman Empire with the Christianization, a completely new worldview, because the old worldview that is currently governing our society it has failed. It's falling apart. It doesn't work. It doesn't produce a functioning society. And those kinds of paradigm shifts take a very long time. They can take generations. With the Christianization of the Roman Empire, it took hundreds of years, 300 years, 400 years. And so what do we do now? Because we're alive now, right? And we can't just live for something that might happen generations down the road. And what I suggest there is retribalization, essentially doing things that affect our own lives with where we live, who we associate with, and so on, similar to what religious communities do, in the sense that religious communities are usually not political in the sense that they are in conflict with the government and they try to change the government and so on. Instead, religious communities, they look out for the religious community. They look out for their own community. And I think that people with traditional values and so on will start moving in that direction and focusing more and more on what they themselves can do in their own lives and how they can help each other out. Because as the governments and as the overall power structure fails to provide the necessary functions for their lives, they have to start looking out for themselves. And that's sort of what the gist or the main point of that speech.
So do you think that the government is going to increasingly fail to provide the things that people need?
Absolutely. If you have a system, a political system, a paradigm built on false ideas, it will fall apart. It doesn't work. Because the map doesn't match the territory. And so everything falls apart. We have a system where we're supposed to believe that everyone is equal and just close our eyes to the fact that everyone is not equal. Things like that, of course. I mean, everyone probably watching this, most people watching this know that. But the point is that that also makes society fall apart in so many ways because it is all built on ideology rather than on observations of fact. And so I think society has already started falling apart in that sense, in the sense that it fails to provide safety. It fails to provide a sense of belonging. It fails to provide even material, basic material comfort or the necessary material needs for people. I mean, there's talk even in Sweden now of perhaps the power grid falling apart because they can't provide electricity. Power plants are failing. I mean, this is a society that no longer manages to uphold normal standards anymore. And with the war and with COVID lockdowns and everything, everything has just started falling apart with the economic crisis that followed and so on. And I mean, we can always speculate how much of this is part of a plan and how much is stupidity. I would suggest that it's basically impossible to think, to be so stupid or ignorant to think that you can shut everything down for a year and a half and think that there will be no economic repercussions, right?
Well, so, I don't think they were worried about the economic repercussions. That's the thing. You know, this is a huge question that right. we've just touched on there about whether this is all part of a plan, because they're talking about the Great Reset. They've been talking about it for two and a half years now. It was like May 2020 when I think when I first heard about and saw the face of Klaus Schwab on the screen for the first time. It was a very strange, I'm sure I've said it many times, so I don't need to go into it now, but the point is, they're talking about the Great Reset, and they're still not clear about what this actually means, the Fourth Industrial Revolution. I know that Klaus Schwab's written at least one book about it, but in terms of their PR, you get these videos with the, you know, the tinkly xylophone and the ukulele music and all that.
Yeah.
Where it's like one idea, like we could live like this in the future. Maybe people will do this in the future, sort of thing. So do you think that the World Economic Forum and all of that stuff, do you think it's basically detached technocrats dreaming and that they're not really in touch with reality and that it won't... their various predictions and all of that won't really come to anything because they're incompetent and events will overtake these people?
Well, no, I don't think that they're incompetent. I don't think that they control everything in detail. But I think that they pretty much channel, shall we say, the wishes or the ideologies of the ruling class or of the more, so shall we say, powerful people in society. Because we're living in a society where, of course, the people who go to Davos, the sort of the wealthy people, the influential people, I mean, when they see, for example, immigration, maybe they have gone to some elite university where they've had a brown person who is well-educated and from a wealthy family. That's the kind of immigration they care about. It's very different from the kind of immigration that, for example, the British or French or German working class experiences in their daily lives. And so I think we have a society that is more and more atomized, an individualistic society, a capitalist society, a materialist society that has very little in way of community, where people care very little about the sort of normal person who has no power. And so I think that these people have these visions of what the future can be. And what do those visions entail? Well, progress is one of them, where progress is an end in itself. I mean, if something is newer, sort of like if you get a new cell phone, right? If you get a new mobile phone, a smartphone, the newer model is by definition better. I mean, it's by definition better to have a newer thing. And I think that goes for everything. And it is simply, even if it doesn't work as well. I mean, it's always better to do something online than to go somewhere like into like a physical bank office or a post office and run an errand. It's always better to do it online, right? By definition, because that's just how it's supposed to be. And it doesn't really matter to them that people become alienated and they think that this is a people feel deep down that this is a horrible society, because they're so wrapped up in their vision of progress, of this sort of utopianism. We can micromanage society in a way that we never have disease again. And it doesn't matter that the solution is actually worse than the problem. It doesn't matter to them. I mean, because it's ideology, right? They're fanatics. And they don't see themselves as fanatics, because they take it for granted that, well, of course it's good. If we can make sure that disease never becomes a problem again, why wouldn't we do that? Well, because all these things mean that you have to micromanage all of society in such a way that it becomes completely alien to normal human expectations, and where people feel at home. And these changes happen so quickly, so rapidly, that the alienation is on such a level that nostalgia now is nostalgia moves closer and closer in time. I mean, in the sense that if 5 years ago maybe I thought that, well, 20 years ago maybe it wasn't so bad, and now I'm thinking, well, 4 years ago was pretty good compared to what we have now. Happens so rapidly.
Well, again, the watershed moment of 2020, do have nostalgia for 2019, which seems incredible. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that, just to be clear, it doesn't mean that I think it was great or whatever. No, I just mean it was a more pleasant way of life than the one we've become accustomed to since then. That's all I'm saying about that. I guess the question comes to, how competent are they? Because if they can't provide basic necessities, if they can't provide an energy structure or a program that works, then there's no point in them having any dreams above that level. They've got to get to that level first. They've got to be to have that in place. And I think to some extent they did have that in place until Nord Stream and the Russia sanctions and so on. But of course, other people would say, well, actually they didn't, because our economies were all running on debt for decades and decades. And it was always going to, the bubble was always going to burst. And then there are people who think that COVID was part of that as well. But I've forgotten the thing now. But in Event 201, in late 2019, there was a thing with in the world of high finance. I can't remember what it was now. But there are people who say that COVID was basically a way to controlled demolition of the economy, because otherwise it was going to happen organically and much more chaotically. Do you have any thoughts about that?
If it was all intended to crash the economy and crash everything, or what do you mean? That I think there's very little evidence we can always speculate, and that's the problem, that these kinds of conclusions always depend on a lot of speculation. And I would think that it would help our credibility to just talk about the things that we can actually prove and that we know, because there's enough of that. There's plenty of stuff that we can just prove and put out there and show. And so speculation could be fun, but it also sort of reduces the credibility of the other stuff that we're talking about, because then we can come across as if all of what we're talking about is speculation when it isn't. I would think that these are all these things that have happened, I think, are predictable steps in the way of their ideology. And to the question whether they're competent or not, I think they're competent in the sense that other revolutionaries or other people who have false ideologies or false ideologies based on false premises or false ideas. People like Lenin and Stalin were very competent in the sense that they were able to dominate society and hold on to their power and gain power. And so, they have their competence, but their their ideology is based on false anthropology. It's based on a false idea of what human beings are, and that's why it leads to a lot of misery. But you can make people very miserable for a very long time, and especially now when we can, when the people in power have so much power, where they can micromanage everything. And you know, one thing that I find very creepy is the disappearance of cash. In Scandinavia, for example, you can no longer use cash in most places. A few years ago, it was maybe one or two places where you could only pay with your card, but they wouldn't accept cash. Now it's like 95% of places don't accept cash. So you have to pay with your credit card, which means that everything is traceable, manageable. You cannot do anything. I mean, it just adds to the sort of the control, the top-down control. And the same thing with these, the digital passports and all these things, it just tightens the screws and creates a more sort of claustrophobic society, right? And it becomes very unpleasant. And they can always motivate it with, well, it's so easy, it's so efficient, and so on. And but you get rid of the human element. And so my point is that with all that technology, and with all that top-down power, they can be as incompetent as they like, but they'll still hold on to power, right? Because who's going to challenge them?
Yeah, that's a grim prognosis. And I think that is the thing. If there's one thing that they are competent at, it's surveilling the population and making sure dealing with rivals and dealing with potential rivals. The state, whether you're talking about Canada, Britain, Sweden, Germany, France, in each of these countries, there's been something that I've heard about, some news story where, a potential coup, the police raided 100 homes, 100 people are now in prison, massive operations like that. Now, the speculation that some of those are put on for a public show. But either way, we know from our own experience that the state is good at surveilling people and monitoring, restricting, cajoling, and just generally pressuring people to stop doing things that it doesn't want them to be doing. And to do things that it wants them to do. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they are definitely competent at that. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like that's the one thing that they are definitely competent at, is what would be the word? Stymieing potential rivals.
Yeah, I mean, just look at the war in Ukraine now, where there is definitely fighting between rival powers within the elites, so to speak, and they see him as a rival, and they're very competent at fighting against him, and they're competent at shutting down everything else that sort of goes against whatever that they cannot control. So yeah, they're competent at doing that, because failing has a very definite and concrete cost for them, for them personally, right? If they can't hold on to the very power, but at the same time, long term, their power is also sort of diminished by a society that doesn't function, because the price of getting rid of a normal functioning high trust society is that you're left with a low trust society, and in a low trust society, nothing works. It becomes more and more difficult to enforce anything because people stop caring. That's what happened with the Soviet Union, with communism, where, you know, people start paying lip service to what they're expected to do, but no one really believes in it. So it's all built on a false compliance. People comply and pay lip service, but deep down, they don't believe in anything. So it's a very sort of fragile, brittle form of power that doesn't go very deep. And so, I mean, we see a legacy of that now in Eastern Europe, where people are far less likely to comply with government mandates and government policies and so on. They sort of do the bare minimum to just get by, but they don't really believe. They have a huge distrust of power. And of course, that is going to develop that in that way as well in Western Europe and Northern Europe.
Yeah, it does feel like things are going in that way. And of course, we should, I guess, mention the key issue. Well, one of the key components of this, which is mass immigration. Our societies are changing so fast, you know, even since 2015, 2016, you know, it's recognizably different in all over Europe, partly, of course, because of the migrant crisis that occurred around that time, but also the stuff that's all the migration that's happened since then. And it's increasing year by year. And I think as much as that is a very depressing thing, depressing process, it is eventually going to have the effect that I just don't think our societies, as they have functioned, are going to be sustainable. You could say, well, yes, but they'll just implement a police state, and I think they will. I think they're doing that now. In fact, I think we've basically already got that. But eventually, even that will fail because we all know it's going to be ethnic nepotism throughout the police. I mean, with the child grooming in Britain, we saw that. You know, the Pakistani police officers were integral to how that functioned. So the point is, diversity is, we're going to see that the normies are going to get a terrible lesson in the fact that diversity really is not your strength. It weakens a society catastrophically. The more of it you have, the weaker your society is, the more brazen the nepotism will be, the corruption, the bending of rules, the breaking of rules. It's going to be a terrible, terrible wake-up call, I think. And you were talking, I think, about a different reason for society breaking down, which was that people simply don't believe in the ideology of it, the wokery, diversity, whatever. But then there's this reason as well for society breaking down, which is that, well, the diversity itself is just going to make things untenable.
Yeah, that you exactly, and that's another thing that I've talked about a lot through the years is that when they were on the rise, the leftists, the communists, call them what you want, they were competent. They were very sharp. If you look at the leftists in the 70s, they had sharp people representing them in public. But they started implementing and believing in their own ideas. So they filled their own ranks with very incompetent people. And so that's what they're left with. But at the same time, they have so much money and so much technology that I don't really see that there's any rival going to sort of challenge their power anytime soon. I saw a funny video clip the other day, a couple of days ago, from the American Army, with black women behaving like black women, but in the army, you know, like a Shaniqua on the bus, you know, yelling and bobbing her head and like all that stuff. But in the army, well, if you have an army like that, that's sort of a challenge to your own power. But at the same time, if your technology is vastly superior to everything else, then you can afford to be sloppy. And of course, that's how power works, that when you're very powerful, you think that you can afford to be sloppy and to be lazy and to not be sharp. And that works for a time, but it doesn't work forever. And so that's why elites change, because old elites become lazy and incompetent. And I think that those cycles, of course, they're sort of shorter cycles. I guess the American Empire is probably the most short-lived empire in human history. It lasted for about 75 years compared to the thousands of years that old empires lasted.
Mm. Well, I was talking about that with White Papers a couple of hours ago. Would you like to talk about the Afghanistan and, well, Afghanistan first and America's withdrawal?
Well, no, I don't really have much to say about it. I just think that that's sort of the result of corruption and a country that completely lacks a sense of direction. And I think it's the same in most American wars, that it's a country that lacks direction, and they just have corrupt elites, and that they're so their actions are going to be somewhat haphazard, so I don't think that there's a lot to say about it, really. It's just an empire that's has incompetent people running the show, and I don't really think that there's much to say about Afghanistan, really.
Okay, so let's get to the one of the key issues of this year, which is the war in Ukraine. And I think that you have quite a nuanced view of this. Would you like to summarize that for people now? Because I'm not sure if I should say anything here. There is a perception that the war in Ukraine is, as much as it's bad news for the Ukrainians and it's terrible, and as much as they have the right to self-determination, ultimately geopolitics is a reality, and a weak country is going to be used as a sort of football between two superpowers, Russia and America, and that is basically what's happening here, and the needs and desires of the Ukrainians are secondary to the needs and desires of Russia and the needs and desires of America. And so what would you have to say about all of that?
Well, yes, it is a reality, but it's also, I mean, all of these things, I kind of object to this whole the terminology about realistic geopolitics. Well, all of this is realism because it's happening in the real world, right? So Russian supposed geopolitical interests, that's a reality that we have to take into consideration, but so is Ukraine's political interests, and so is America's political interests. And I mean, all of these factors are just as real. And
of course.
And that's why I find so ridiculous with these sort of the Mersheimer fans and so on, because they talk about Russia's interests are so real. And that's the realism here, is to take Russia's security interest into consideration. But all the other interests are also real, and they're just ignored. You know, there was a debate between Mersheimer and Walt on the one hand, and what's his name, the Polish politician Sikorski, and McFaul, the former American ambassador, I guess, and another political sort of high up political commentator. And that was a very interesting debate. Did you see that debate?
No, I didn't, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, it was a few months ago. It was a very worthwhile debate. Of course, Mersheimer and Walt are, you know, very much talking about this whole thing with Russia's security interests. We must take that in consideration. And they polled the audience at the beginning of the debate, and everyone was in favor of Mersheimer and Walt before the debate started. This is a big mainstream thing. Probably everyone in the listening to this will recognize the names, because very prominent people. Mersheimer and Walt wrote the Israel Lobby in 2006, I believe, 2005. Very sort of prominent professors at Chicago and Harvard, respectively, in political science, and sort of anti-establishment figures to some extent. And so the audience, that they polled the audience, and they started out as sympathetic to Mersheimer and Walt.
And what was their position, just to summarize that?
Their position was that we have to sort of compromise with Russia. Basically, we have to give Russia what they want, because otherwise, or I'm sort of simplifying it, but basically they were sort of more sympathetic to the Russian point of view, because they said that if we don't agree with it, it'll end in nuclear war or whatever, you know, Russia will feel cornered. We have to sort of appease them, basically. And the others said, no, of course, Poland is notoriously, the Polish sort of establishment is notoriously hostile to Russia for obvious historical and geographic reasons. And McFaul is an American establishment figure. And so the audience, I think this was in Toronto or something, a very, you can imagine a PC, politically correct audience in Toronto, you know, one of the most PC cities in the world. And they started out as sympathetic to Mearsheimer and Walt, but during the debate, they, when they polled them after the debate, they had changed their mind. And the thing is that Mearsheimer and Walt had, they were correct in what they said. And what they said was namely, well, we can compare this to the Cuban Missile Crisis and say that Russia feels threatened, so of course they will not allow you know, NATO to expand and so on. So they had that talking point. But the problem is that they only had that talking point, and they had no answers to all the other talking points that the other side had. And I feel that that is, my impression is that is how people have drawn their conclusions about their conflict. They've heard one talking point, and then they think that settles it. Well, but it doesn't, because there are many, many other interests involved here. And first of all, even if you grant that the comparison with the Cuban Missile Crisis is valid, which I sort of don't, because that was an actual situation, whereas in the situation with Ukraine and Russia, there are no nukes involved in Ukraine, and Ukraine and before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the West and America and NATO said, we will not intervene if Russia invades Ukraine. And they have said repeatedly that Ukraine is not allowed to join NATO, because that would mean that they would have to defend Ukraine in case Russia invades. And they are not willing to do that. So they basically had a war guarantee before invading Ukraine. They had a war guarantee from America saying that we're not going to intervene. We're not going to send
food. But America has intervened, hasn't it? And yeah, Canada hasn't sent its army, but it's sent apparently so much of its military material that it doesn't have any left.
Exactly,
is what I heard. So, on the one hand, yeah, they haven't. These other countries haven't intervened. They have
intervened by proxy.
But exactly.
Yeah, but here's the point. That's why the comparison is all I'm saying. That's why the comparison isn't entirely valid. Now we can get to how much they've intervened as well, because I think that debate is worthwhile. People should go back and watch it, because both sides were somewhat dishonest. my point is just that comparison is a bit overblown, because the Cuban Missile Crisis was an actual situation. Here it is a speculation about a possible situation that they've basically guaranteed that's not going to happen. I believe that America doesn't want to send troops to defend Ukraine. They want Russia to waste resources in Ukraine. And they want Russia to lose credibility, lose troops. And I mean, the West is just lose morale. And the West, if we call NATO, the West is massively winning this. And if you compare, the part of the American military budget that has gone into this versus the part of the Russian military budget that has gone into this, I mean, America is fighting a war at discount, and they have essentially Ukraine fighting a war for them. I mean, from their perspective, that's what happens. That's what's going on here. And so the only winners really here so far is NATO. NATO has two new members now. NATO has revived its reason to exist. And America is sort of, I'm not going to say breaking the back of Russia, the Russian military, but severely decimating the Russian military power at a discount price. And so I can't really see
A discount price for America.
Exactly. At a discount price for America. I mean, not if for America. Europe. Exactly. That's my point.
Yeah.
So I mean, who is gaining from this war? Not Russia, really.
No, America. So,
yeah, exactly.
I would agree with you on that.
Yeah. So the whole point that this somehow weakens the West, or weakens, that this war is sort of hurting NATO in some way. It really is not. So yeah, I think that this war is just a disaster from all reasonable points of view, and I don't think that there was any real threat of nukes in Ukraine comparable to the Cuban Missile Crisis. So yeah, I think that this war is just a complete disaster.
Yeah, I think most wars are really. But,
but even from a like strategic or whatever you want to call it, geopolitical or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you say that there were no nukes, so Russia didn't really have anything to fear.
I wouldn't say that. But I just say that particular comparison is not entirely valid, because there were significant differences in the situations.
Yeah, of course.
They have something to fear, absolutely.
I'm not interested in this comparison with the Cuban Missile Crisis, because that's something that they thought would be rhetorically useful to them in that debate. But it's its own issue. I'm interested in just this matter. Would you say that from Vladimir Putin's point of view, he presumably felt that he was justified in worrying about what NATO or the West was planning, why it wouldn't give the guarantees about no weapons would be stationed there in firing distance of Moscow and all that kind of stuff. I mean, was that an unfounded fear on his part? Do you think that he didn't need to do what he's done?
Well, we need to do what he's done. I mean, of course, he would think that he is being threatened. I mean, but NATO is already bordering on St. Petersburg. Is literally on the NATO border. I mean, you can't get a city closer than that. This is not a new situation. Of course, he finds himself threatened and has to draw a line somewhere, and so on. There's no dispute about that. The things that I've been questioning in what Western sort of right wingers have been advocating is that this is somehow in the interest of dissidents in the West, and that dissidents in the West have something to gain from Putin, and that Putin is based and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this that's just madness, complete insanity.
Oh yeah, I think on that we're definitely in agreement. I mean, it's I was never a huge. I'm not a fan of Putin, and this is something that did annoy me, is how the debate quickly became polarized into you're either for the Ukrainian people and you want them to survive, or for some reason you don't care whether they survive or not, and you may even want them genocided, and you're a Kremlin Putin shill.
Huh.
I think that's a silly thing that happened, and I wish it hadn't happened within our movement, that it became polarized like that. Because the truth is, most people in the West, I think, have no opinion at all about Ukraine. They don't. It's unfortunately a horrible thing to say, but it's a country that isn't very prominent, and most people don't really know anything about it. So For most people, it was an entirely new thing to hear about and to learn about this country in far flung Eastern Europe and its ancient beef with Russia. For most people, that's new to them. So they don't have a vested in, and they certainly don't have a some long-standing love of Vladimir Putin that now they're finally able to express for the first. I mean, that's just not like that.
Yeah, and really, that's the interest I've taken in it as well. That this is sort of a sign of, should we say, the sort of the Jerry Springerification of the right in the West, right? Where everything is reduced to sort of, it's sort of a shock jock thing. It's almost like Fed posting, right? People supporting a Russian invasion of a European country. That's almost like Fed. It's like being an internet tough guy. And that's it. That's not metapolitics. That's just being a clown. And it's sort of it becomes this sort of trash entertainment. When the biggest war in European history since the Second World War, an invasion of the largest country in Europe, seen to the geographically largest country in Europe, when is being invaded, and the whitest country in Europe being invaded, and people start cheering. That is not only a bad look; that is a sign of terminal illness in a political movement,
and a total lack of seriousness.
Yeah,
it is a serious issue. I mean, even with you know, like the absurdities about the Ukraine war, you know, Zelensky and that transgender reporter that I was talking about earlier, and the film stars going over there, and Bono and U2 going over there. Even with these farcical elements, we're still ultimately talking about a real war with real injuries and deaths and maimings and God knows what atrocities going on either side. So it is a very real matter. And I think you're right. You want to speak?
Well, yeah. Again, I wanted to just compare the seriousness of the supposed right with the left. And when the left was sharp, for example, with the Vietnam War, if you go back and look at debates where the sort of radical left is, where people like Noam Chomsky and other people debate about the Vietnam War, they know what they're talking about. They have an actual analysis. They have something. They don't just have like simple memes and saying that Zelensky is gay. Well, that doesn't really prove that you know anything about the war, because the war started years before Zelensky became president. I mean, so basically, we're just seeing it's sort of like Alex Jones. It's just like politics as entertainment, but without any serious ambition. And I just see that as a tragic, again, sort of terminal illness in a metapolitical movement when you can't even provide an attempt at a serious analysis of the biggest war since the Second World War. I mean, this is a huge event. We should have somewhat serious comments about it, but instead it's like Ukraine has Jewish oligarchs. Zelensky is gay. America is gay. You're fighting for the gay disco. I mean, that's not analysis. That's just a clown show, you know? That's just Jerry Springer. We need something more than that. And so that's why I've kind of reacted immediately from day one to these kinds of sort of clownish talking points. You should be able to provide more of an analysis than that if you're going to say that you're a credible metapolitical movement, because that's the only thing we have. We don't have resources. We don't have money. We don't have platforms. We don't have anything else than our credibility. And it's pretty sad to just throw that away.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, one thing I would say is, as I said earlier, that this was new to a lot of people. In the same way that COVID was, you know, when it first happened, a lot of people were nailing their colours to the mast immediately, saying, we're going to shut everything down, or it's completely fake, whatever. It was sort of very extreme, polarised early on, and then changed their minds a couple of months in and started to switch and say, okay, this is obviously a load of rubbish and all that. Because it was new to them. And then other people were more careful I was one of them, I'm pleased to say. And I didn't really declare anything about COVID and for quite a few months in. And I took the same attitude with Ukraine. I'm not saying this to boast, by the way. I'm just saying I'm surprised that more people aren't like this, to be honest. It seems like common sense. If you don't know much about a topic, why would you pontificate about it? It just seems kind of silly. So I did the same thing with Ukraine because, as I said, I didn't know anything about it. But as the months passed, it did seem like, well, as I said earlier, and my position, you know, I still broadly have that same position, that I think this was a war that America wanted and goaded into happening, and and now they've got it. And as you said, they're not even expending their own soldiers' lives to fight it. So Ukraine is being used as a sort of proxy, well, it's a proxy war between two massive entities. One of them, you might say, a rising power, Russia, and one of them, you might say, a dying power, well, America.
I'm not sure I would say that Russia is a rising power. I think we've seen, I mean, this is also something that, you know, I know a lot of Russians, and the image I always get, or the impression I always get, is that Russia is a Potemkin village. You know, it's very important to show that Russia big, strong. But then, I mean, we see everyone expected Russia to do much better in this war, including myself. I expected Russia to do much better now. But, you know, 2 weeks to flatten the country turned into 9 months in retreating. And this, so this has been a huge cost for Russia. And not just in human lives and in material resources, but also in credibility. And I think that they feel kind of cornered because of that. So I don't know that they are a rising power. I mean, how many people have fled the country since the war started because they don't want to be a part of it? So I wouldn't say that it's a rising power. I think it's a decaying power, just like America is.
Right. Okay. Someone says, "Have you looked at the value of the ruble compared to the U.S. dollar recently?" I think this is the implication being that Russia is actually doing very well out of this war.
Well, I think that they called this a military operation because they thought it was going to be something less than a large war, but that term sounds kind of ridiculous now. A special military operation with full mobilization of the country, and they've presumably lost 100,000 soldiers on both sides. So, I mean, 200,000 soldiers together. I mean, this is a huge deal. So I thought that I think that they made some miscalculations of how this war was going to go. And I think that the Western powers or the Western establishment is sort of reaping the benefits, and Ukraine is suffering because of it.
I would agree with that. I mean, I know that they changed the Russians changed their military commander to someone who's more hardline, more ruthless, about 3 months ago, two or 3 months ago now. So I don't know. I think they did, for whatever reason, underestimate how difficult it would actually be difficult to take this country over. Well, assuming that that's what they wanted. Either way, difficult to achieve their objectives, let's put it that way. So, I mean, would you predict that this is going to be and I know predictions are not the best way to go about this, but just for the sake of it, would you predict that this war will still be with us a year from now, for example?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is going to be a drawn-out war. But like I said, predictions are extremely difficult in these times because, well, everything changes and we don't really have any sort of inside information about what's going on. But judging from how things are going, I don't think that... I don't think that the Ukrainians are willing to surrender to the Russians. There's only a growing hatred, obviously, of Russia in Ukraine after this, and Russia can't afford to lose or to give up. So I think that this will be a very drawn out conflict. And like I said, you know, America is fighting a war at discount price, and that's another reason why I think that this sort of meme analysis of the war is kind of ridiculous. That, you know, the meme and the sort of the memes with Zelensky as like a welfare queen getting a lot of money. I mean, the point is that, yeah, that's funny, but if you want to understand what's actually going on here, this is not American charity. This is America fighting a war at discount price. So, you know, I think that sort of analysis here is a bit more apt.
So what would, in summary then, what is America gaining from this war?
Well, I think that it's just in the nature of power that power wants to expand. And, you know, I did two interviews in 2018 when... And again, you know, a lot of people think that this war is new. No, it started 8 years ago, 9 years ago. I did interviews in 2018, two interviews, one with sort of the pro-Russian side and one with the pro-Ukrainian side. And with Alexander Dugin from Russia and with Olena Semenyaka from Ukraine, and she is the international secretary for a nationalist party there. I think she has a position in the parliament now. But the interesting thing was what they agreed on. And they're, like I said, on opposite sides of this conflict. And they agreed, both of them, that Western hostilities toward Putin are not political or ideological. They just see him as a rival. And... I mean, that's just the nature of power. You fight against your rivals. You want to get rid of... I mean, sort of imagine the Godfather, you know, assassinating rival gang leaders, gangster bosses. That's just how power works, you know. You fight over territory, you fight over power, you fight over influence, and... I don't think that you have to go much deeper than that, really.
Yeah.
I think America wants, you know, it's the same thing in the Cold War, right? Against Stalin. Not because, I mean, they were friends with Stalin. Uncle Joe, they thought that he was fantastic. But then they couldn't control him. And so there was the Cold War because they cannot accept, because these people... need total power, so they cannot accept that there are world leaders that they cannot control, and that sort of annoys them, you know. And it's, I mean, I think this is connected. It's connected with their worldview. They think that everything you can micromanage everything that happens in the world. You can get rid of people who like world leaders who don't obey you. You can get rid of disease. You can just control everything in detail. And this is sort of the sort of utopianism.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Ideology as well. There are people on our side who believe that you know, Putin is all part of one system. So Putin is a World Economic Forum graduate or whatever they call it. So this is all prearranged, and he's playing a role effectively. That does, I will say, I think that's absurd. I don't think that's true. But I'm, you know, I might end up eating those words.
But no. I think that would sort of grant too much power to the World Economic Forum. I don't think that Klaus Schwab is the grand wizard controlling everything.
Exactly.
That's going on in the world.
Exactly. I think what's more likely here is that Putin did some course at their... at some point, but then he that didn't mean that he was ideologically or in any way on board with them. No. It could have just been a formality. Whenever he showed up for a seminar once.
No, I mean what Putin is and what Russia is a continuation of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union ended, but there's a lot of lingering aspects of the Soviet Union. So I just think that this is just a continuation of the same kind of rivalry that was going on in the Cold War. There is an aspect of the West cannot control Putin or control Russia. But after the Second World War, there was sort of a world order established. A world order based on an ideology of, let's call it anti-fascism, not really anti-fascism, more anti-national socialism. The French writer Maurice Bardèche wrote a book, I think a year after the Nuremberg trial, and he said that what was on trial at Nuremberg wasn't Germany. It was the very idea of nationalism. So after the Second World War, nationalism, nations are no longer accepted. The ideas and ideologies in the sort of the should we call it fascist countries, national socialism, and so on. Those ideologies are now the complete evil. That was what was on trial, and that is true both for America and for Russia, for the East. And national socialism was. I mean, this is something that people get completely wrong because of Hollywood. Hollywood would portray national socialism as, you know, persecuting Jews. That's not really what national socialism was. The main objective of national socialism was to fight against communism, to fight against the Russian threat. When people volunteered from all over Europe to join the Waffen-SS in the Second World War, it was to fight against the Russian threat. And so you'll still see people in Eastern Europe, they will still identify with that fight, and you'll still see people in Russia identify with that fight from the other side. I mean, the Russian soldier, they will wear this orange and black ribbon, the ribbon of St. George, which is the symbol of the Red Army, and it's the symbol of Victory Day, and that is sort of the founding myth of modern Russia, is their victory over Nazi Germany and the Nazi Europe, right? And so that's what they mean by this denazification, which is one of the two objectives of this war. And so there is still that is still their identity. They still celebrate Stalin. The entire ruling class of Russia was created literally by the Soviet Union. I mean, Putin was, of course, a KGB agent. After that, he was the head of the FSB, which is the successor, which is essentially KGB with new letters. Before he became the president, he was the head of the FSB. So, I mean, this is not, there's not a sort of a decommunization of Russia like there was a denazification of Germany. So, I mean, this, you can't think that because the Soviet Union was dismantled 30 years ago, that they just did a 180 and everything changed. Of course not. I mean, this is a huge empire. They have their way of doing things. And the entire ruling class was, of course, created, or, you know, they were born, raised in the Soviet Union. And like I said, this whole war has even that rhetoric built into it, where the Russian army sees itself as the heirs of the Red Army fighting against the sort of Nazis. And you'll even see that in Eastern Europe, where people also see this threat from Russia, where they identify with the Waffen-SS. You know, I've even seen, you know, people, old people singing their version of SS marschiert in Feindesland, which is like the SS anthem, in their local language, just because they see it, okay, these are the Europeans fighting against Russia, and Russia is like the big threat to those countries. And so both sides play into that dynamic. So my point is that there is a continuation with this sort of anti-fascist ideology, anti-Nazi ideology, both in Russia and in America, in the liberal versus sort of post-communist system. But it's still part of the same ideology. So they're still rival forces, and they hate each other because they can't control each other. And we're sort of stuck in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, and the Ukraine is stuck in the middle. In a very real way. So I'm not sure what else to ask you about the Ukraine war. what would you say about the Nord Stream incident?
Well, it was very interesting, especially considering that Swedish news said that that Swedish military ships had been spotted in the area, and they had turned off their tracking devices around the time the explosion happened. So I would be pretty, I would be surprised if there wasn't some foul play from Sweden in that respect, just based on what I know from Swedish mass media. Who is behind it? I don't know. Mark Weber thinks that perhaps it's Poland. Who knows? I mean, I think it's pointless to speculate about who is behind the blowing up Nord Stream. I don't know. I don't think anyone outside of the sort of inner sources or inner circles of power know that. So it's just a part of the war, you know. But it had that vibe of, you know, this is sort of a, like in the history books, you know, it's sort of like, I've compared it to like the invasion of Norway during the Second World War or something like that, where, you know, these countries, country after country, gets sort of dragged into the conflict. And that still might happen. I sort of think that it probably will not, because everyone knows what's at stake when there are nukes involved. So I kind of think, I'm inclined to believe that the war will not expand beyond the borders of Ukraine and Russia, at least not, you know, outside of the immediate area there. I don't think that they will... that NATO countries will get involved.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I don't think it will spread far beyond where it is just now. But I mean, I am surprised to hear you say about Nord Stream. I mean, don't you think it's likely that it was America?
It could be. I mean, there are many countries that have objected to Nord Stream, and Poland being one of them that has objected very loudly. And many countries have objected, and Ukraine as well, of course. And I mean, we can speculate. There are many candidates for who was behind it. But like I said, even the Swedish news, the state news, wrote about Swedish ships, Swedish vessels, Navy vessels being spotted in the area at the time of the explosion under suspicious circumstances because they had their tracking devices turned off, their whatever they call GPS system for ships, right? So there's obviously something fishy going on there. Where Sweden probably had something to do with it. I don't know. But I'm just speculating here. I'm not going to say that I know anything. Yeah. But I'm just saying that there are weird things out there. And also the fact that this is in the... what do they call it? Like the Swedish economic zone, Swedish and Danish economic zones, but it's not in Swedish territory, which means that Sweden does not have an obligation or to defend that place, but it's in sort of the economic territory. So there's kind of protecting who gets to investigate and doesn't get to investigate. And so it's very vague what's actually going on there. But of course, it was in many countries' interest to blow it up. So, I mean, I don't really think it matters all that much if it was America or Poland or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to be, I would say it seems obvious that America would be the biggest candidate here because it has the ability to do it. There's, of course, the motivation to do it. There's the clip from Biden saying that there will be no more Nord Stream.
yeah, that was convenient.
Yeah, exactly. So, and of course, it perpetuates the war that America wanted because it cuts off that option for Germany to pull out of funding it and whatever. So, I mean, that would seem a logical answer. Whereas Poland and Sweden, I would they have the expertise or the ability to pull off something like this? I would think that the Royal Navy in Britain and America are probably the powers most likely. I guess we should both be careful about what we say about.
Yeah, I'm not going to speculate exactly, but like I said, there are just like clues out there that suggests. Suggests kind of weird things, but we can only speculate, and I don't think that there's any point in that. I don't think it matters. I mean, I think that probably if NATO countries did it, they probably have the blessing of America at least.
Oh, certainly. certainly. Excuse me. Okay, I will. We've only got like 10 minutes left, so I will have a look and see if there are any super chats. I might have missed some on Odyssey, but I don't think I actually did, so that's fine. And there was one from nice one from Olivia saying excellent opening evening for Millennial, many thanks. Well, thank you very much, Olivia. Okay, well, is there anything else you'd like to say about 2022 before we finish?
Let me see here. Well, I don't really know. No, I mean, there are, I took some notes of what I've done in this year, and it's a lot. It's been a very productive year. One thing that I've talked about a lot on my channel is this thing with incels and with the Zoomers not having social skills and so on. So I've talked a lot about that, and I think that has been very
You've had a very productive year. I mean, I've noticed. I hadn't seen the speech that you put up a few weeks ago, but I've been watching your activity this year, and it seems to have been a very productive one for you.
Yeah, it's been incredibly productive. And of course, we did the Cameron Film Festival as well and so on. But I think I've sort of taken my work into a more practical direction, I guess. Instead of talking about the problems, I've talked more about solutions. In a way, or sort of constructive ways forward. And I think that, you know, we've talked about this before, about the problem with the lack of social skills in sort of fringe circles and in the dissident politics and on the right and so on. And I've, I guess, taken it upon myself to try to remedy some of that. I've talked about, you know, I don't think that people are doomed to be low on social skills, even though they may be there now, because I think that these things can improve. And I think that that's something that would help if we got people to improve in that area of their life. It would improve their own lives, of course, immensely, but it would also improve the lives for people who interact with them, you know? And I think that would benefit everyone. And so that's why I've focused quite a lot on this whole idea of social skills and practical steps that people can take to improve their social skills. So again, I mean, this is a focus on what you can do in your private life that is not specifically political, but I think that those are the areas of your life that you should focus on, where you have influence. It's like the Stoics. I always bring up this idea that the Stoics had, right? The Stoic philosophers, that, you know, there are things that you have power over and there are things you don't have power over. You can live your entire life complaining about the things that you cannot change.
And worrying about them as well.
And worrying about them, exactly. You can think that, why wasn't I born in a wealthy family? Why wasn't I mean, or things that happened in the past? Why did I do that? Or worry about things that might happen in the future? But the Stoic idea is you let go of those problems that you have no power over, and then you focus on the things you do have power over. And right now, it is complete fantasy land to think that you're going to change the overall political system in the entire West, and there's going to be some sort of political revolution. Or no, it's not going to happen. You're in no position to do that. What you can do is you can improve things, sort of hands-on things in your own life and you can improve things for your own community and so on. So those, I guess that has been the overall focus of my work this year.
All right, that sounds very good and I laudable. I mean, I think it's admirable. And I think that what you just said there really has matched, it ties into a development within myself this year as well. Maybe last year too, but especially this year, where I've just stopped caring about things that I can't influence. There's just no point, because all it does is drain you and wear you down and depress you. And you know why? You know, even if the thing is something that does matter, you know, if I can't affect it and influence it, then it's someone else's problem. And you know, I've tried to adopt that attitude, which is a bit, you could say, it's a bit nihilistic, a bit cynical. But it's also just good for self-preservation, because what's the point of grinding your metal, trying to, or worrying about things that you've got no influence over? You've got to eventually, I think, sort of detach from them to some extent and just think, okay, well, what will happen will happen. It's not my problem, and I'll just try to insulate myself from it becoming my problem. That's with a lot of stuff, that's all you can do.
Yeah, and that will also increase your own bitterness. And bitterness is a huge factor in the sort of, in people who are low on social skills. They tend to be very bitter, and they tend to be very depressive, and they tend to think that, well, other people just have to put up with me being depressed, you know. That it's sort of like an entitled attitude. You have a right to just spread this sort of negativity around you. Not really. I mean, that's kind of a hostile thing to do toward people around you. I mean, why should they put up with that?
We should say that I don't think people do this deliberately or consciously. It's just as a behavior that sort of develops over time, and like a bad habit that develops. I mean, I don't think many people actively choose to develop a bad habit. It's something that happens insidiously.
But they should question it, you know. I mean, my point with saying that is that, well, if you're like a depressed person and you drag other people down, then you should question what right you have to do that. I mean, it's sort of like you're poisoning people, other people around you. Do you have a right to do that? I mean, you should start. I mean, and I of course, people who are depressed and who have those very negative vibes, that's the last thing they do, of course, because they think about their own problems and so on. But the point is, I think that that's kind of a valuable thing to do, is just question, okay, well, I mean, isn't this kind of entitled to think that I should just spread my bitterness all around and so on, right? Because it is, but of course, the people who are doing it, that's the last thing they want to do, is question their right to do so. But I think it's a good reminder to tell them that, you know, well, maybe that's not okay, you know, maybe that's not very good behavior. So no, but my point is that these things can be improved. You're not sort of doomed to eternal misery just because you're born in certain circumstances, or, you know, if you're born on the sort of spurgier end of the spectrum, right? Because, and that's another thing, you know, people say, oh, it's just Spurgs. Well, it's not entirely true, because a lot of people, even diagnosed with Asperger's or with autism, can learn to have good social skills.
Exactly. So I mean, there have always been men who were just socially awkward, and I was pretty socially awkward when I was younger. I think loads of guys actually are, by default, socially awkward, because socializing doesn't come as naturally to us, and the skills involved in it don't come as naturally to us as they do to women. So lots of young, especially young guys, are, you know, it takes time to learn how to be confident in your own skin, how to not worry so much about what people think of you and whatever, and how to respond in a productive and natural, organic way to things that people say to you. You know, it sounds autistic, but I think even within the normal range of male behavior, these things don't necessarily come naturally to a guy. And there is no real apparatus around for inculcating these skills into young men, which I think there used to be. you know, that's what I was saying. I think there have always been guys who that we would now call spergy, or that we would now call like properly autistic. I think they always existed. They just weren't called. It's the same way with ADHD. You know, boys were always boisterous. Society used to expect that, not be surprised or shocked or puzzled by it, and just had ways to deal with it. These things have always been there, I think.
No, exactly. And my point is that, you know, I feel bad for the people who think that, well, I'm just spurgy. That just means that I'll just be alone and I'll not have any social success. No, people will not like me or anything like that. You know, that's not true, because you can actually learn these things. And I think it's kind of, I think it's very harmful for those people to start believing in that, well, just because I'm spurgy, I can never learn any social skills, because you can, you know, that's the point, that these things can be learned. And that's sort of what I've been talking about a lot, because there's obviously a massive overrepresentation of people with those characteristics in these spheres, in these circles. And I think that a lot of them can be helped to you know, improve themselves and to get better lives for themselves and for everyone else around them, you know. So it's not like it's like not like a death sentence if you start out with low social skills, because that's something that can be improved. But and like I said, you know, if you just accept that, then you get sort of an anti-social movement that's going nowhere. So you have to take care of that problem if you're going to move forward in any productive way. And so that's basically been one of the main focuses for this year.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you about that. And it sounds like a very good, productive, you know, worthy direction to take your work in. So I applaud that. So, all right, well, let's wrap this one up. And I'll be back in 10 or 15 minutes with the next one. Let me just see. I've actually forgotten who the... it's James Tucker next. Okay. Well, Frody, any final words?
I just want to thank you so much. I think Millennial is an excellent tradition. And like I said, I think this is the sixth year I'm on. It's always a pleasure. It's always a privilege to be here. And I always find out about a lot of new people, because I'm not as active in following people who have their channels and so on. And I've talked a lot about the problems of social media this year, but this is one of the very good things on social media. you're improving things a lot by doing this. So I think this is amazing. And if people want to follow my work, I'm on... you can follow me on Telegram, Guide to Culture, KULCHUR, and I'm doing a live stream every Tuesday with Mark Weber called Weekly Roundup with Mark Weber. And we do current events, commentary, news commentary, and so on. And it's gaining a lot of popularity, and I think it's very helpful for people to put news and current events into wider context. Like I said, Mark Weber is a historian, sort of a veteran in these circles, a veteran of many decades in this circle. So that's where you'll find me. It's every Tuesday, Tuesday evening at 9 o'clock Central European time, which is 8 o'clock in England. And I think it's 3 o'clock in the American East Coast. So yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. Night Nation says, good discussion, gentlemen. I agree about the social skills issue. It's an important problem to be fixed for the building of the community. Yes, I agree. Okay, so Frody, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2022. I will be back in about 10, 15 minutes. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available in the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and speak. spread the word.